does it really mean to be well-informed these days? I mean, there's just so much information flying around, right? Mm. Are you really getting to the heart of things? Well, here on The Deep Dive, that's what we try to do. We take a pile of sources, could be articles, talks, notes, you name it, cut through the noise, and just give you the key stuff. Today, we're doing a really fascinating deep dive. It's on a compound called SLUPP332. And our sources are kind of interesting this time. It's a mixed part conversation, part detailed seminar transcript. So you get the personal experience side and the deep science stuff. Our mission today, pretty straightforward. Unpack SLUPP332. What is it? Where did it come from? How does it actually work in your cells? And importantly, what are the real world uses we're seeing? Plus, you know, the nuances, things to watch out for. Oh, and a quick shout out. This deep dive is brought to you by InfinityPeptide.com. Okay, so let's kick things off. Here's something maybe a bit surprising about SLUPP332. Or SLU. It's actually been around much longer than you might think, based on the recent buzz.
Yeah, that's right. The research, it actually dates back to 2000.
2000. Wow. So why is it suddenly everywhere now? How did that happen?
Well, it's got a bit of an origin story. It wasn't just created out of nowhere. It evolved from an older compound, GSK4716. Now, GSK4716, it modulated estrogen-related receptors, the beta and gamma ones.
Okay.
But, and this is key, didn't really hit the alpha receptor. And that alpha stimulation turns out to be super important for what SLU does.
Ah, okay. So the original one was missing a piece of the puzzle.
Exactly. The big breakthrough was a modification they made to that GSK compound. They extended part of the structure at phenylalanine 328 specifically. And this allowed for something called pi P stacking. Think of it like making a key fit a lock perfectly.
Gotcha. Better fit.
A much better, much more efficient fit, specifically for that alpha estrogen-related receptor. And that improvement led to the whole family of SLUs, with SLUPP332 being, well, the most efficient one they found.
Super interesting. And then the real-world use started showing up. When was that? Around 2018.
Yeah, about then. And initially, it was for pretty specific things. Reversing chronic kidney disease, CKD, and also enlarged livers.
Right. I remember reading that. HPA. Enlarged livers. And it worked well.
Yeah, reports were it was quite effective for those conditions.
But then things shifted. The big aha moment, you could say, came from the Olympics.
Kind of, yeah. The drug-tested Olympic community, athletes found out it wasn't banned. Completely legal.
Huh, okay.
And they started noticing really significant improvements. Strength, endurance, putting on lean muscle, even making weight cuts easier.
Wow. Okay, that would definitely get people's attention.
Absolutely. Those consistent results really sparked the wider interest.
And that led to this shift, right? From something really hard and expensive to make yourself.
Oh, yeah, totally. You used to need a CAS number, labs. It was a whole process. Very laborious, very expensive.
To now 2024, 2025, it's becoming much more widely available.
Exactly. Thanks to some early online sellers, you know, Bio something was one of the first movers, I think. They really paved the way for access.
And that's what we're digging into, why this stuff is having such a profound effect. It's more than just another supplement. So to really get SLU, we need to talk mitochondria, but let's be clear. We are not just calling them the powerhouses of the cell today. Okay. They do way, way more important things.
Huh. Definitely. Forget the powerhouse trope. They're involved in like 10 billion other critical processes.
But maybe walk us through the structure a bit in simple terms. What do we need to know?
Okay. Yeah. Think layers. You've got the outer membrane, pretty permeable. Things get through easily. Then the space between membranes, the inner membrane space. That's where proton ions build up, which is important for energy later. And then the inner membrane. This one's much pickier, less permeable. It controls what really gets inside.
Okay, outer, inner membrane space. Inner, got it.
And that inner membrane isn't smooth. It has all these folds called cristae.
Cristae, right. Why the folds?
Surface area. It massively jacks up the surface area inside. And that huge surface area is absolutely critical for all the chemical signaling for compounds like SLU to interact efficiently. More space for reactions.
Makes sense, like radiators having fins.
Exactly. And deep inside all that is the matrix. That's where you find the mitochondrial DNA, the stuff you only get from your mother, and mitochondrial ribosomes for building proteins right there on site.
So proteins get made in the mitochondria too?
Well, the instructions come from the cell's main DNA, the nucleus, sends out mRNA. That mRNA tells ribosomes, maybe outside or inside, to make an unfolded protein. But getting that protein into the mitochondria and working, that's a journey.
How does that work?
It needs help. It uses special doorways called translocases. Think Tom and Tim proteins and chaperone proteins guide it through the membranes. Mm. Once inside and processed correctly, it folds into its final shape and becomes, you know, active. epigenetically active, it starts sending real signals, causing real changes in the cell.
So it's this incredibly complex delivery and activation system, not just energy production.
Precisely. They're sophisticated signaling hubs. And SLU seems to tap right into that complexity.
Which is why understanding this foundation is key to seeing SLU's full potential. Okay, so we know SLU is an agonist for estrogen-related receptors, ERRs, mostly the alpha one. But let's back up. What are ERRs? They sound like estrogen receptors, but they're not quite the same, right?
Right. That related part is important. They're structurally similar, but functionally distinct. And they're often called orphan class receptors.
Orphan? Why?
Because they don't have a clear, obvious, natural partner, an endogenous ligand that binds to them like many other receptors do, but they're still active somehow, which is pretty intriguing.
So what does activate them then, if not a specific hormone?
Well, here's a big one, and it might surprise you. Cholesterol.
Cholesterol?
Yeah.
Really? But isn't cholesterol supposed to be bad?
That's the conventional wisdom, but it's maybe too simplistic. Cholesterol is actually a major agonist for these ERRs. And consider this, a huge study in Japan, like 20 million people, found increased cardiac risk when cholesterol was below 200.
Below 200, increased risk.
Yeah. Suggesting the sweet spot might actually be higher, maybe 200 to 250, aiming for the low 200s. It challenges the lower is always better idea.
That definitely flies in the face of a lot of advice. What about statins, then?
Well, it adds context, right? We've seen statin use go way up, but cardiac events and mortality haven't necessarily dropped proportionally. It suggests cholesterol does more than just clog arteries. It's vital for cell membrane integrity, things ERRs influence.
Okay, so cholesterol is one activator. What else? You mentioned they can be active without a ligand.
Exactly. Their structure, they usually have this N-terminal end, a DNA binding part, a hinge, and the ligand binding domain allows for activation through other means, things like acetylation, somyelation, phosphorylation, basically chemical tags added to the N-terminal end. These tags can change the receptor's fate, turn it on or off, without anything binding where a ligand normally would.
So the receptor itself can be modified to become active.
Precisely. Which also brings up a potential issue. If someone has, say, a structural problem with their ERR, maybe the N-terminal's messed up or the hinge region isn't right.
They might react badly to something like SLU.
It's a possibility. It could explain some negative responses. And unlike, say, androgen receptors, where sometimes flooding the system helps, we can't really fix broken ERRs easily right now.
Okay, that's important context. Now, there are different types of ERRs, right? Alpha, beta, gamma.
Yep, three main types. ER alpha is the most highly expressed. Think cardiac benefits, energy, muscle function, that's largely alpha. ER alpha is the least expressed. It's more involved in cell growth, proliferation, differentiation. And ER gamma is moderately expressed. It's linked more closely to mitochondria themselves and also brain function.
And SLU hits mainly alpha, but the others too.
Primarily alpha, very strongly. But it does have effects related to beta and gamma activity as well, likely through stimulating alpha, which then crosstalks. That stimulation of all three, especially the abundant alpha, is why you see such broad effects.
That synergy makes sense. It's not just one switch being flipped.
Not at all. It's more like orchestrating a whole cellular symphony.
Okay, now let's zoom out even further. You mentioned SLU fits into a bigger picture, an axis involving PGC1-alpha. Tell us about that connection.
Right, the PGC1-alpha axis, it's a major regulator of energy metabolism, mitochondrial biogenesis, lots of things. And everything here crosstalks. Stimulating PGC1-alpha directly boosts the expression of ERR-alpha. So more PGC1-alpha means more ER-alpha receptors available.
Okay, so they work together.
They definitely work together. PGC1-alpha even forms complexes with estrogen receptors, too. It's all interconnected.
So how do we naturally stimulate this PGC1-alpha pathway?
Several ways. Fasting is a big one. Directly stimulates PGC1-alpha, increases ERR-alpha. Being hypocaloric dieting basically also does it. That works through the AMPK axis, another energy sensor.
AMPK, right. Turn to that.
Yeah, AMPK modulation stimulates PGC1-alpha, which then improves mitochondrial function, especially in the heart. Better density, strength, less fibrotic tissue.
Any common substances that interact here?
Metformin is a well-known one. It hits the AMPK pathway and seems to interact directly with ERRs as well.
So fasting, dieting, even metformin, they all tap into this same interconnected system that SLU also influences.
Exactly. If you poke one part of this network, you'll likely get ripples affecting other parts. The strength varies, but the connections are there. SLU is like a potent key player within that network.
Okay, fascinating stuff. Now let's pivot to the real-world impact. Theory is great, But what are people actually experiencing with SLU? You've seen a lot since 2018, right?
Yeah, we've tracked experiences from over 500 clients. And this is crucial because lab results don't always capture the full picture for athletes or people with health issues or just, you know, regular folks.
Totally. So what are the big areas where you see effects? Let's break it down.
Okay, let's go system by system maybe. Hurst, stem cells. We see SLU upregulating bone marrow stem cells, making them multiply and differentiate more effectively.
So it helps your body make more stem cells.
And improves how they work. It's been used to seriously boost the effects of stem cell therapies people get from outside sources. And you can combine it with things that naturally support your own stem cells, stem regions, Eucodian, algae, aloe, that kind of stuff.
Interesting. Okay, what about muscle? Biological effects.
Yeah, big impact there. It helps shift muscle fiber types, leaning towards glycolytic fibers, and boosts glycogen storage inside the muscle. This drives anabolism, hypertrophy basically, muscle growth, and strength potential. It helps balance fiber types.
And fat loss.
Adipocytes.
This one's really unique. SLU drives both lipolysis, fat breakdown, and beta oxidation, fat burning. But it does it in a parasympathetic state.
Parasympathetic. Like rest and digest. Usually fat burning is linked to stimulants, right?
Exactly. Usually you need caffeine, ephedrine, that sympathetic drive. SLU lets you tap into fat stores more efficiently, even when you're relaxed during those non-training hours, aiming for ideally like 20 hours a day in that parasympathetic state for fat loss.
That's a game changer. Okay. Strength.
It helps indirectly by improving ATP recycling, powering those glycolytic fibers better. But also, it fuels recovery between heavy efforts, think powerlifters, between attempts. That relies on the parasympathetic fat-burning system SLU enhances.
Makes sense. Endurance.
My theory here is it improves CO2 management. Better CO2 handling means better oxygen delivery via the Bohr effect. We've seen crazy results in breath holds, Olympic athletes adding 20 seconds in days, deep sea divers adding a minute or two in weeks.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Cardiac tissue, heart health.
Yeah. Clear benefits, reduced inflammation, less oxidative stress on the heart. We see improvements in ejection fraction, less ventricular hypertrophy, that's heart enlargement, and less fibrosis, tissue, which interestingly also links to.
Sexual function you mentioned, we'll get there. What about kidneys first, renal?
Right. Improvements there too. Better EGFR, creatinine levels. Reduced inflammation and oxidative load. This tracks back to its original use for CKD.
And the liver, hepatic.
Similar story. Improves standard liver markers like ALT, AST, helps with dysfunctions indicated by things like alkaline phosphatase or bilirubin, again, consistent with its early use.
Okay, it's hitting a lot of core organs. What about the brain?
Definitely acts as a neurotropic and neuroinflammatory modulator. It's an antioxidant in the brain, managing reactive oxygen species. We've also seen it modulate neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin. Some people have even been able to reduce or come off dopamine reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, under supervision, of course.
Really? That's significant.
Yeah. Leads to less neural inflammation, better recovery. We've actually seen this reflected in scans of pro athletes.
Incredible. Even eyes. Ocular tissue.
Yeah, this was a personal one for me. I actually reversed my need for glasses using it. We've also heard reports from archers, NFL quarterbacks, about improved visual clarity.
How does that even work?
It could be better nutrient use in the eye, maybe an estrogenic effect there. Still exploring the exact mechanism.
Okay, what about general inflammation?
Modulates key markers for most people. IL-6, TNF-alpha, HSCRP tend to go down. Though be careful, very high doses might tank IL-6 too much.
Good to know.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, sexual dysfunction.
Okay, two parts here. For males, it seems to improve blood flow dynamics in erectile tissue and reduce that fibrotic tissue buildup. This observation came partly from the post-finasteride syndrome community.
And for females.
It causes an interesting epigenetic change in clitoral sensitivity. This increased sensitivity can last weeks, even months after stopping, which has found uses in performance contexts.
Man, that list is extensive. It really seems to touch almost everything.
It has a remarkably broad reach, yeah. Based on observations, it really does seem to do it all in some capacity across many systems.
Okay, so we've heard the amazing range of benefits, but we have to talk about the other side. The nuances, potential downsides, even if they're rare, people need to know, right?
Absolutely crucial. Even if it only affects a small percentage, you need to be aware. So let's cover potential negative considerations.
What's first?
Gynecomastia. Male breast tissue growth. Now, this is rare. Remember, SLU hits estrogen-related receptors.
Not estrogen receptors themselves.
Primarily, no. But there seems to be potential for some. Let's call it crosstalk in certain individuals. Some interaction with the actual estrogen receptors that could rarely lead to gyno.
Okay, rare, but possible. What else?
Tachycardia, increased heart rate. This one's a bit weird because SLU isn't a stimulant.
Right, so why would heart rate go up?
Couple of hypotheses. Maybe an indirect effect of increased stroke volume. The heart's pumping more blood per beat, so it adjusts rate. Or maybe it's neurological, an imbalance triggered in dopamine or other neurotransmitters affecting heart rate. Still investigating.
Okay. Anything else, Major?
Yes, and this is probably the most important one to understand, especially regarding dose. Reactive oxygen species, ROS overproduction.
ROS, like oxidative stress.
Exactly. This isn't unique to SLU. It's a risk with any mitochondrial peptide or supplement if you push the dose way too high into super physiological levels. See, when mitochondria make ATP, they naturally produce some ROS as exhaust. When SLU makes the ATP-producing enzymes, ATPases, spin much faster to generate tons of energy.
It creates more exhaust, more ROS.
Precisely. Too much ROS leads to systemic fatigue, lethargy, feeling drained, ironically, kind of like being wiped out from too much caffeine, and it can actually prevent adaptation.
How does it prevent adaptation? That sounds counterintuitive.
Think of Dr. Hans Selye's stress adapt principle. You need a certain amount of stress for your body to react and get stronger or better. If you're constantly healing or pushing energy production so hard with SLU that ROS levels are chronically high, you might blunt that necessary stress signal. Too much of a good thing prevents the biological trigger for progress.
Wow. So trying too hard to optimize with high doses could actually backfire and stop you from improving long term.
It's a definite possibility. That paradox is key. Sometimes less is more for adaptation.
Okay, that is a critical point, which leads perfectly into the most practical advice. Dosage. You absolutely have to find your range, right?
100%. This is maybe the most critical takeaway. Forget standard doses. Find your own reference range. Everyone's different.
And we should focus less on half-life and peak levels.
And more on the effects, yeah. The acute non-genomic effects you feel quickly, and the longer-term genomic epigenetic changes that build up.
So where does someone start? What's a sensible approach?
Okay. General guideline, and always best with a practitioner overseeing. The minimum effective dose seems to be around 100 to 200 micrograms. Below that, there just isn't enough chemical pressure to do much. Most people feel positives with minimal negatives in that 100, 200 milligram starting range.
And does the dose change depending on the person?
Big time. Interestingly, populations that are sicker or more dysfunctional often need more SLU, maybe 400 micrograms or even higher to get effects.
Why more?
Probably less efficient mitochondria to start with. Maybe lifestyle factors, less sun, poor diet, bad sleep, reducing their baseline function. They need a bigger push.
And athletes?
Athletes generally need less. Their systems are usually more efficient, maybe in the 400, 600 microgram range total, sometimes even less. Some find their sweet spot caps out around 400.
Is there an upper limit where benefits stop or risks increase?
Yeah, most people seem to hit a ceiling around 1 milligram, so 1,000 micrograms. Going higher, up to 2 milligrams or more, the benefits usually don't increase, but that risk of ROS overproduction definitely goes up.
So how do you find your number between, say, 100 millisiegan and 1 milligram?
The best way is careful trial and titration. Start low, maybe 100 millisiegrams. Every other week, increase by another 100 millisiegrams. And crucially, take notes. How do you feel? How's your performance? Energy? Sleep? Watch for that point where things stop improving or maybe even slightly decline.
And that point right before the decline is your sweet spot.
Exactly. Then you either hold there or pull back slightly to the previous dose that felt best. It requires patience and listening to your body.
What about how to take it? Injection? Oral?
Good question. Currently, the data and experience suggest the oral preparation is just as effective as other methods. So oral is generally the way to go right now.
Okay, oral. Start low. Titrate slowly. Take notes. Find your individual peak. That sounds like solid advice.
It's the only way to really personalize it and get the benefits while minimizing potential issues.
All right. What a journey today. We've covered SLU PPE-332 from its surprisingly deep history.
Yeah, evolving from GSK-4716, that clever modification for alpha ERR activation,
to how it interacts with mitochondria in ways far beyond just energy, affecting signaling and protein activation.
And navigating the complexities of those orphan ERRs, cholesterol's unexpected role, the whole PGC1-alpha connection.
And then the sheer breadth of real-world effects. Stem cells, muscle, fat, heart, kidneys, brain, eyes, inflammation, sexual function. It's kind of mind-blowing.
It really is. And yet, like we said, even though it's been around, it feels still so new in terms of widespread understanding. sharing these experiences, connecting them back to the science, that's still so important.
Absolutely. And crucial to remember the potential downsides, the rare gyno or tachycardia risk, and that very real concern about ROS overproduction if you push the dose too high.
Finding that personal sweet spot is everything.
Definitely. So here's a thought to leave you with. Knowing that one compound can touch so many different systems, muscle, fat, vision, mood, energy recovery, and understanding that paradox that sometimes trying too hard to heal or optimize can block adaptation. What does that make you think about the incredible interconnectedness of your own body? And how might this perspective shift your approach, not just to health, but maybe to progress and optimization in other parts of your life too? Something to ponder. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into SLU PP332. Remember, the insights we shared today were brought to you by InfinityPeptide.com. Until next time, keep digging deeper, keep questioning, and keep learning.